This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the we just hit a million orders stage. No matter what stage you're in, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/special offer.
Hey everybody, welcome to Literary Disco on Lit Hub Radio, episode 174, Middlemarch, part 5. Today, we continue our march through Middlemarch as we read...
Wow, you're better than that.
Clever.
You're better than that. You're better than that.
Book 5, The Dead Hand. This is Literary Disco, the last book club you'll ever need. We are Todd, Julia, and Ryder, three old friends who love to read, debate, and sometimes even agree. I am actor and filmmaker Ryder Strong. Joining me, as always, our novelist and critic Todd Goldberg, and essayist and radio personality Julia Pistel.
I feel so bad for the listeners. Like, they heard that, and
at least
at
you
home,
didn't say we are marching through the middle.
Right.
That's
well,
true.
In fact, we are marching through the middle.
Well, I realized, like, every time I've started to do the introduction, I'm always, like, tempted to talk about it being a slog or being long. And it's I don't want to imply that because it's actually moving pretty quickly for me now. It's just that it's long, you know? And yes. So I don't want to be negative. So March actually felt about right. If I had said Death March, you know.
Wow, we're making it worse.
I mean, there are parts in the book that are, like, walking through gravel with molasses on your feet.
Yeah, so let's talk about what part are you thinking of in book 5? That was like that.
You know, actually book 5 is pretty quick moving because there's a lot of big plot points in it.
Yeah.
So this was actually a speedier part of it. And it actually
You guys
is the
have
most...
said that. I just want to stop and say the two of you have said that every single time.
Time
since the first week.
Well,
actually this is pretty quick.
this part is notably absent of Dorothea. And Dorothea spends a lot of her time thinking and pondering and woe is me-ing through her fucking pages. And that tends to drag the pace down. There is some of the, again, like dreadful political stuff, but then it pays off.
Yeah.
Because it turns out that we've been told all this political stuff that I've summarily forgotten immediately after reading it, that there's a larger reason why it's included in the book and not just for local color.
That's why I started to get scared because, you know, once it became apparent that, like, it's going to be a big part of, that Mr. Brooke running for office and the Tories and the Whigs, like all of that stuff, as just my eyes glaze over. And I'm like, I don't need to know all the details about this. And I've also been the same way about most of the hospital stuff. I'm like, I don't need to know all the details about it. But like this book makes it apparent that like the actual ins and outs of who's voting for the hospital or who, you know, what they think of Ladislaw. Lydgate, which again, I keep confusing those two.
Yeah, she needed a better editor. Like, you don't have two names that are very similar, particularly not in a book where every fucking person has the same fucking last name, because everyone's fucking everyone's sister in this.
So honestly, do either of you know what is happening with the hospital situation? Like, can you, like, I think I could do like a really generic, like, there's a new hospital being built and Lydgate is the new doctor in town. And so he's going to take the position of running this new hospital, and that's politically perilous.
Right.
Is that?
Yes, because he's not from the area.
So
I cannot go into any more detail than that.
The important thing, I mean, in general, I agree that this is the hardest part of this, and I am fascinated by that because, well, I'll get into that in a second. But to answer your question, Lydgate needs money. And he needs support, and he needs other doctors to work at the hospital. So the problem with this tiny town is that everybody's married to everybody's sister, as Todd just said, in a different way. And personal feelings and political feelings are interfering with the building of the hospital and the clergy. All of these things, money, politics, medicine, and religion are mixed up together. And Lydgate has a problem in that he's too irritating because he's so sure of himself and not tactful at all that everybody doesn't like him and he's annoying. But he's the one.
He's like that know-it-all Dr. Fauci.
Yes. So this is exactly where I'm going. So these parts,
that's amazing.
We all agree these parts are horribly boring. But when you summarize them, it is like, it's upsetting.
I actually didn't find it boring when the sequence in this book that we read today, the following the rumor mill and like how like little casual conversations between a husband and a wife become facts for the whole like landscape of Middlemarch. I thought that was great. And it was super entertaining to be like, oh yeah, you know, it was about four pages there just tracking like how he got this reputation.
And
but
beyond,
Lydgate's not bothered by it, right? He's not like, he's kind of like,
because he thinks he's right. Yeah. He knows he's right.
Right,
right.
And he's willing to play the game for the greater good. Like, look, if I got to take some slings and arrows, that's great. I'm going to open up this fever hospital.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But the thing is, like, we're in a moment where politics, medicine, money, and religion are so intermingled as to be, we're all being like, this is boring in this book. And then closing the book and going online and reading about these four things. To an obsessive degree.
Yes, you're so right. You are so right. But that's the problem, is that these very important subjects are kind of boring to think about and read about. You end up having boring scientists and boring doctors like Fauci who have spent their entire life on these boring subjects. I need to listen to them right now.
Guys,
that's such a good point.
Literally got into an argument on a local politician who I know's Facebook page with a priest because he called the Riverside County medical supervisor a know-it-all. And this know-it-all is telling me that I can't have services. And I was like, yes. He's a know-it-all.
He knows things about diseases that you don't know.
Like, you're working on a theory that there's God. He knows there's a virus. And then I got kicked off Facebook for a week.
Oh, okay.
Jesus.
But you know what I mean, though, right? We're all like, blah, blah, blah.
Super,
get to the marriage plots. Yeah. And it's really sobering. I want to talk... The fever stuff, I actually don't find that hard. But the elections.
Political.
And it's important to understand that this was a period piece even when she wrote it. We said that, I think, in the first episode, but she's commenting.
Yeah, she's making references. Yeah, she made references to some sort of like dry election or dry, you know, and I was like, I feel like that's something I should know. But it was interesting that she's looking back 30 years or so, right?
But there was one when Mr. Brooke is giving his like horrifying speech.
I loved that beat.
And, you know, there's an effigy of himself being burned. Now, I think Mr. Brooke is an okay dude, but this passage, oh my God, I can't find it. I'm going to freak out. Was so Trumpy in the way that he was like interrupting himself, just the cadence of it.
Yep.
That I
oh,
was
yeah.
like
just
consumed.
Talking nonsense.
Right.
Yeah. Shoot, where is it? There's not a lot of underlining in these parts because I was just trying to focus. Oh, well, I lost it, but...
I got it. We must look all over the globe. Observation with extensive view. Must look everywhere, from China to Peru, as somebody says. Johnson, I think. The Rambler, you know. This is what I have done to a certain point, not as far as Peru.
That's it.
I've not always stayed at home. I saw it wouldn't do. I've been in 11, where some of the middle marchers... It's like amazing. Yeah, he's just rambling and can't find his way. And they describe it as if he's like lost at sea, and he'll eventually get back to it, but then they start throwing eggs.
Perfect.
Yeah. Well,
that's
great.
I was this is our moment.
Yeah. What we haven't yet discussed is that there's a huge significant plot point with, in fact, Dorothea.
Yes.
Yes.
Where her aged 46-year-old husband, someone on Twitter was like, you guys, if you just do the math, it's Casaubon is 46 years old.
Is that true? He's really only 46?
Yeah.
Oh,
because
God.
Dorothea's 19 and he's 27 years older than her. So that makes him 46 or 3 years younger than me. And so Casaubon and Dorothea, as you might recall from the last episode, they're having sort of they're having a fight. And then Casaubon has a fatty heart, it's determined. and everything's sort of like their relationship is on the rocks. So in this section, Dorothea basically comes to the conclusion of, look, I'm in this shit. I'm going to see it through. I'm going to love this guy. I'm going to do whatever I can. Casaubon, meanwhile, is like, I don't trust this girl. I'm not even sure I really like this girl. And I don't think she cares if I live or die. This girl's, she's out of my life. She's out of my life. I'm going to take a walk.
No, wait a second. You're skipping something very important.
There's a very, he does something almost like worse than that.
Yeah. He does the worst thing he could.
He basically makes her promise
not
to finish
you.
His book. Yes. No, before that.
Right.
Because, I mean, the will is like the second.
Right.
But before that, he basically says, it's not good enough to me that you're going to dedicate your entire life to my musty books and like
my
shitty
book.
My
life.
Index.
You have to write my book for the rest of your life. Index my book for the rest of your life after I die. And she can't, and for the first time, she can't say she'll do it. I was like, that is some bullshit right there.
Yeah.
It's like, it's not good enough that you married me. You have to, you know, and then the will, of course, which is the second betrayal.
Yeah. So
He dies in a stressed out position, which I didn't remember.
Sitting in a chair in a field, holding his brow.
And you're kind of relieved because
Yeah.
you don't
Fuck
want her
guy.
To have to make this promise.
No.
You're like, don't do it. But she's about to do it. She's about to say yes,
yeah.
I guess.
So
she's so terrible. Yeah.
Dorothy is basically like, if this is my life, so be it. Like, fine. I will fucking index your glossary until my dying day.
And the thing about knowing Dorothea as well as we do now, we know that she can't say yes to him and not do it after
he
dies.
Yes, exactly.
Because it's so interesting because I was like, you know, this is not something that I would have known if they started the book here. But because we spent so much time with this character, she is going to hold herself to her promise until she dies.
Right.
And that's why she's so devastating that he makes her do it, because he knows her as well in the same way as we do. And it's so, go on.
So Casaubon takes the long dirt nap, and they read his will, and one of the contingencies of his will is that Dorothea is to be taken care of unless she marries again. And if she marries again, she gets nothing.
Well, no,
specifically
if she marries
Will Ladislaw.
That's it. She can marry again. He's just pinpointed the rival.
Right.
And spelled it out. So then the rumor mill's going to pick up on it. It's horrible.
So his beautiful curl-dappled mullet, sun-dappled curl mullet can never love her. It's so sad.
But then I loved that the irony is it's the first time that because of the will, it's the first time Dorothea is able to imagine Will as her lover.
Right.
So Casaubon actually made the thing that he was most fearful of come to life because of his actions. So I love that. I loved that.
Casaubon, it turns out, not a great guy.
Not a good guy.
Not a good husband in life nor in death.
Okay, so I think the time has come for us to fully discuss Ladislaw. He's finally, you know, given some interior time in this instead of being a pretty boy. And I really, really liked his little chapters really fleshing him out. I thought he was annoying and kind of a fuckboy, but I've changed my mind.
Yeah, no, he's intelligent, and like his political stuff seems to be, you know, going well.
Am I wrong?
Kind of a fuck boy.
No. But well, he was always clever. I mean, I remember I had positive associations because he and Dorothea, their conversations were sophisticated and clever.
Flirty.
But yeah, like as far as like his life aspirations or what he was doing in Middlemarch, it all seemed a little kind of shady or like just playboyish, and now it's like, no, he's like trying to be a respectful person and thinking about a political career and you know, in the future, and he's a good writer apparently, and he's bringing, you know, those skills to bear, and he's really helpful to Mr. Brook, who seems a little lost, so it's
and he's
all,
always
like,
looking for people's rugs to lie on, which I thought was really funny.
You know, he starts off as Timothy Chalamet, and then he becomes Paul Rudd.
Wow, that's some really generous That's really, really generous. But yeah.
And then eventually he'll become Paul Reiser.
So. Amazing. I think, like, the writing, I'm looking at it right now, which is why I'm talking so slowly, is really nice around him because he could easily just be, you know, I'm in love with her. I can't wait for this guy to die. But George Eliot spends a lot of time explaining that he didn't want Casaubon to die because, essentially, because Ladislaw has such a romantic idea of his life that he doesn't want anything to change, including this, you know, love triangle. So,
right.
Yeah.
I just love that. Here we go. Will, we know, could not bear the thought. Oh, I also underline this. She starts writing, we know, like, we're all telling this story together in this book, which I really love.
Yeah, I did too.
It's a strange, it's a strange bit.
Will, we know, could not bear the thought of any flaw appearing in his crystal. He was at once exasperated and delighted by the calm freedom with which Dorothea looked at him and spoke to him. And there was something so exquisite in thinking of her just as she was that he could not long for a change which must somehow change her. Do we not shun the street version of a fine melody, or shrink from the news that the rarity, some bit of chiseling or engraving perhaps, which we have dwelt on, even with exultation in the trouble it has cost us to snatch glimpses of it, is really not an uncommon thing and may be obtained as an everyday possession? I love that.
Oh, so good.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I was just happy he got some of these pages of the deep thought.
Yeah.
And then, so all that happens, and that's all interesting. And then the book for about a chapter becomes Great Expectations.
Yeah,
it kind of comes out of nowhere. But
completely inexplicably, it becomes...
It did feel Dickensian. Yeah. It felt Dickensian. It also reminded me of, like, a Faulkner plot, because I feel like there's always some, you know, bastard child out there who's extorting somebody for money in Faulkner, too.
So this character, Bulstrode, is that what he says? Bulstrode?
Yeah.
Who I...
Religious figure.
Didn't really have any memory of.
He's always been around giving people money and getting votes and stuff.
Yeah, he's been on the side of things. Apparently, 10 years previous, he had paid off a bit of a grifter named Raffles to go to America and hide the truth of an affair that Bulstrode had had. And now Raffles has shown back up, basically as Magwitch in Great Expectations, to throw a wrench into all the goings-on inside of Middlemarch. He has some great insults that he throws around. He calls Bulstrode a knob, which I quite enjoyed.
Well, I also just love that she manages to make being called Nick, which is his name.
Yeah.
She manages to make that like an insult.
Yeah.
You know, that this guy is just so friendly, overly friendly with Bulstrode. It's like every time you read it, you're like, ooh. My favorite line is when he is condemned to breakfast with him. I was like, that is brilliant. When he first meets Raffles is drunk and he's like, I'll talk to you tomorrow morning. And he goes away. And then the next morning he's coming back and he goes, he sees Mr. Raffles with whom he was condemned to breakfast. I was like, oh my God, I'm going to use that.
There's also just this great description. Bulstrode felt a shuddering nausea. All because of conversation that he's having with this guy, Bulstrode feels this way. It's just it's not just nausea, it's a shuddering nausea. Yeah.
But do you quite understand why? I mean, the whole thing is that Bulstrode has acquired the property that was left in the will from Featherstone, right?
Yeah.
And so he's going to do this to create a church or to create some sort of church community there. Okay. And he's afraid. Yeah.
So Featherstone left it to Rig, this random frog guy.
Who really just wants to be a money exchanger.
Right. Yeah, so he immediately sells the house. Like, yeah, this is, I love that.
This like sad dream that he has to just have the power over money. Not even that powerful of a position, dude. And you don't have to work another day in your life. Yeah. That's what he wants. It's like, okay.
So Bulstrode just buys this estate as his country home or whatever. The all of the stuff about the clergy, there's a church attached to Cosbon's property, and Lydgate convinces Dorothea to install what's-his-face, Fairbrother, a guy who also has a crush on Mary Garth. It's all coming together, right. You guys. It's all coming together.
Yeah. gotcha. Kind of. If I can remember the who these people are.
Fairbrother, I didn't know, quite know how to position him into all this. Whenever he came up, I was like, wait, am I supposed to know him? So,
yeah,
okay.
Another
so this
person.
Is good.
And to Todd's
so
point.
So he's been installed at the church by Dorothea.
Yeah.
Gotcha.
At Lydgate's urging. There's a lot of politics around the hospital involved in this.
Right. Right. And she's also giving £200.
Right. She has $200 to give away.
All right.
Dollars. So American.
Dollars, pounds. By the way. Such an American.
So anyway, Bulstrode
She's got $50 in Instacart that she can send off.
A gift card.
Yeah,
for
a gift
Amazon.
Card to Instacart. Here, go buy yourself a fucking church.
So Bulstrode's just basically got this summer home, and Raffles just wanders up to it while he's, you know, planning his
But Bulstrode had basically sent him to America for what he thought would be the rest of his life, because Raffles knew the secret, and Bulstrode got rid of him.
Right.
And now he's extorting him for money.
And now he's extorting him for money. Yeah.
And he's telling us, the readers, and later... I'm sure other people, that Bulstrode had an affair with Ladislaw's grandma, I think.
Right.
Yeah, that was connection was very hard for me. So it's actually that he is Ladislaw's grandfather?
Step-grandfather. Step-grandfather.
Okay, gotcha.
Yeah, it's a very tenuous relationship that they're hiding.
But
right, because it wasn't that he had a child out of wedlock with this woman. It was that she couldn't find her son or something. Like that's
right.
What I was trying to.
And he had
he hid him. Yeah, but it wasn't his kid.
No,
it was just a woman he had an affair with and her daughter.
That's right. So he is. It's implied that he owes something. Here's what it is. He hid, and I'm sorry, I don't remember what's coming out of my memory.
Her name's Sarah, right?
Sarah is Ladislaw's mother.
Right.
So I think Bulstrode has not been truthful with where the inheritance should go. I think it went to him and not Sarah and Will Ladislaw.
Gotcha.
There's inheritance drama. That's what's the core of this. Is Ladislaw, God, as we know,
so
has no money. Right. He has no money, but he's just a cool poet who now writes political speeches. Classic. Yep. I know a couple
if
of
you were
those.
Alive today,
Chalamet or Rudd.
If you were alive today, he'd have a podcast with those guys that work for Obama.
Exactly. that's amazing.
So, I mean, the narrative is moving towards Ladislaw getting his own money.
Nice.
But Bulstrode is very shady.
Raffles can't remember his name. So Raffles is like, I remember that there's a man involved, and I think his name is L. And we're like, Lydgate? Is it Lydgate? Could it be Lydgate? It might be Lydgate. Could be Lydgate. And he's sort of wandering around this scene. He's wandering around the scene like, if only my memory could tell me, who is this man? Something with an L. As many names with L's are. And then he says, with an actual exclamation point, Ladislaw!
And our hearts drop.
That action of memory, which he had tried to set going and had abandoned in despair, had suddenly completed itself without conscious effort. A common experience, agreeable as a completed sneeze, even if the name remembered is of no value. Well, it's a value to us.
Yeah, thank God.
Dear reader.
Yeah.
Ladislaw.
I mean, I think this is all, it's all pretty dramatic and ridiculous.
Yeah.
And fun.
It could all be solved if everyone just sat down and had an honest conversation about who's been fucking who.
But they're not going to, because this is important.
They're not going to.
This, I think, what is obviously the driving force behind all of this novel is these inheritances and 200 pounds a year and a parish that some random widow assigns you. Like, these are life or death. These are, you feed your family, right, or you don't feed your family. Your
right.
adorable children are educated or they work in a field. I mean, these are huge. Right. We're seeing gossip turn into livelihoods.
Reality. Yeah.
And the opposite of that. So,
but this is something I do think about. Like, when I read all the Jane Austen stuff last summer, which seems like 30 years ago now, I often had the thought of this could all be solved if everyone got into a room and someone just said, look, there's been a misunderstanding.
You like her, she likes you. When have you this one doesn't
ever
like that one.
Known any human beings to do that?
Or I mean, I guess that would be like, that would put the romantic comedy genre of film out of business, and every Hallmark Christmas movie would just screech to a halt. I'm sorry.
All drama.
Right.
All drama.
I'm sorry. There's been a misunderstanding. And be like, oh, so that's it? The show's over?
But no, I think the point is that so many of the big plot points in this novel are just like a slip of paper left in a drawer, you know, a will, or a like, or seemingly offhand conversation between, you know, like nobody's really like they're not even like rushing to talk to each other half the time. They're just kind of running into one another and like having these like little asides that then devastate somebody two houses away. It's pretty tragic. Like, it just makes my feeling like after reading this book is particularly is like Middlemarch as a whole is a pretty cynical book. Mm-hmm. You know, like everybody's kind of like, I'm like, nobody's position in life is very good. They're all under immense pressure and they're all, their personal lives are at odds with their exterior, you know, public life, whether that's their job or their husband or their duty to their husband. It's like, it makes them miserable and they're just beholden to these standards. It's like, oh, it's just so tragic. And the book is really, you know, cynical about that. It's a dark view of human beings in general, it feels like. It's kind of overwhelming.
And of small town life, you know?
Yeah, particularly of small town life. But, you know, I think, so this is the other weird experience I had while reading this the other day. Is like, there's no Winesburg, Ohio without Middlemarch.
Right.
You know, there's no book, and Winesburg, Ohio, by the way, which we could have read in 2 hours. It's like 168 pages. But it's also, so in Winesburg, Ohio, if you haven't read it, listeners, there's this idea of the grotesques, these people that are grotesque that live in this city. And that is all that lives in the city of Middlemarch. It's a city of grotesques. So I'm sort of fascinated to see, to go back to Winesburg, Ohio, maybe if there's sort of like a really quick pandemic next year, like
a long weekend,
a sort of weekend virus.
Chicken pox pandemic, maybe just like writers
dip into Winesburg,
writers butt sick for a weekend, and we read Winesburg, Ohio,
and everyone in America has to stay in their homes,
because of my butt sickness. Yeah. That would be pretty intense.
Rachel Maddow's on. Look, Ryder Strong is butt sick. We need everyone in their
lockdown.
So the next book six. So now we're at the portion.
What are we excited about? What are we looking forward to?
Well, here's what I'm looking forward to. We're now in the portion of the book where actually the last three books are the length of an actual book. It's 300 pages.
Yep.
So book six is entitled The Widow and the Wife. Mm-hmm. I'm fascinated to see what happens with Dorothea. I like that in medias res, George Eliot has decided I need to actually throw in a villain. An actual villain with this Raffles character. She was like, oh, well.
Oh, you think he's going to come back? I think he was kind of a one-off.
Oh, no.
Just to, like, stress out. Oh, okay.
He's
okay,
got
to cool.
be. Because he's a disruptor. Like, he's the right. thing that's disrupting
we need
everything.
That.
So he's going to have to be there. So we're now at the, we're on the plot outline diagram. We are actually pretty close to the climax, even though We still have 300 pages to go. Everything's been set up. All of the consequences have been out there. If you don't do this, this is going to happen. You know, if you do this, that's going to happen. So now it's all going to fall apart.
Yeah, and that's what I'm trying to figure out, because like this is to the point I was saying about it being a cynical book. And I know Julia's just going to have to keep her mouth shut right now. But is this going to have a happy ending at all? Like, you know, it feels like it's not to me. But then I'm wondering what I want the book to do. Like, do I want people to actually fall in love and be together? Or is that going to feel cheap and not reflective of the book, you know, that has been set up thus far, which is that, you know, real life is tougher than that. And you don't really always get what you want. And you're always kind of oppressed by your social status and your social, you know, your lot in life. Even if that means you're wealthy, it's still, you know, fetters, to use a favorite George Eliot word. So I don't know. I have no idea what I want. Like I'm obviously compelled. I want it to be a happy ending for these people because I like the characters. But I would be disappointed if it's too neat, because that's what bothers me about Jane Austen, for instance.
Lydgate will have, to use a favorite term, a shuddering disappointment. There's no way Lydgate succeeds. That's my belief.
Yeah.
And so my belief,
especially since he was set up as so successful in this book,
and he has big blinders on. You know, and there's a lot of bad communication. He's not in a good marriage.
But they're good blinders. Oh, you think the marriage? I think like all the stuff that he's ignoring, like, you know, shitty scientific, you know, interpretations that people are making around him, and that he's ignoring the gossip mill. Like, I think that's great. Like,
so question with Lydgate as it stands, and I don't completely remember the ending, so I'm not like pushing towards anything, is, can you afford, even if you're right, he's obviously right medically, can you afford to be a dick to everyone?
God, good way to put it.
That is the Lydgate struggle.
Lydgate conundrum.
Yeah. Her struggle is, you know, can you live in your absolute beliefs and still be happy? I mean, I'm not sure that's exactly right, but, you know, that's
that sounds,
And then like the Fred Vinci plot, which I really like, even though it's really small.
I do too.
Should you sell out to be a priest
we haven't talked about that section. Happy. I really loved that. Yeah. I love that Mary, you know, Garth sort of calls him out as like, he's going to be horrible as a priest. Like, and I won't love him because he will have, and she calls it something, some kind of affectation, but the way it's phrased is it's such a cool conflict. And again, it's that conflict between their social jobs and their love, you know, it's like, it's always at odds. Everybody has that problem. And yeah, I really felt for Fred.
Are you saying that Fred Vinci is the model for the priest in Fleabag? Is that what you're saying?
Oh my God.
He is. Oh my God. Yep. I think he might
be. The original hot priest.
The original hot priest. Fred Vinci.
Was Fred described as hot? I just remember being named Fred.
Fred is definitely hot. Are you kidding? He loves life. He loves riding around ruining horses. Come on.
Right.
Yeah.
Wow. We are
playing whist.
The long tendrils of this book into all of modern culture. We got Dr. Fauci. We got Fleabag. There's a little Star Wars element to this.
There's clearly a reference to Paul Rudd. There's on almost every other
there's
page.
A clear Paul Rudd reference. Timothy.
Literary Disco is produced and edited by Justin Alvarez for Lit Hub Radio. You can reach out to us directly on Twitter @LiteraryDisco. Happy reading, everybody. Thanks for listening.